Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So here we are in California. There's a phrase that I like to repeat and have been since I've been here, especially. It's called rest in peace. Now it's maybe not a common Buddhist mantra, but it does have some Buddhist themes wrapped up in it. One is death and the other is peace. So the contemplation of death, for example, Buddha placed very high emphasis on this. And it's something that, as monks, we have a bit of freedom to talk about. There's no social stigma. And in fact, the more we talk about it, probably the healthier the relationship with our own death is going to be. When the Buddha advised his disciples on how often they should reflect on death, he didn't say, once a day or every hour. He said, in the time it takes to breathe in and out, if you should have this thought, may I live just long enough that I have, that it takes to breathe in and out, that I have enough time to contemplate the Buddha's teachings. Right? And keeping this idea of death, our own mortality, our own fragility of life close at hand, and reminding ourselves of it regularly, it changes priorities in life. It changes the way we look at life. Certain things which may seem really important in the small picture when we look at a total lifetime or the uncertainty of how long we're going to live actually may not be that important. And it assists in being able to let go, just let go of things. And as a meditation technique or reflection, it's one of the classic ones that we do. And the Buddha praised it highly. Said if there's one meditation that leads to these qualities of, in Pali, it's called nibbita viraga nirodha, like disenchantment, allowing things to cease. Viraga can be dispassion, but also just allowing things to cease, and nirodha, allowing suffering to cease. And upasama, which is like a sense of peace. Abhinya, which is like insight knowledge. Sambodhi awakening and nibbana. So he said if there's one meditation which leads to all of these qualities, it's maranānusati. It's very powerful. I remember one of the ajahns I knew in Thailand for the first 5 years of his monastic existence, is all he did, just contemplating death all the time. And if you can do that to the point where you're absolutely sure you're going to die and you can make peace with it, then that lays a really strong foundation for the rest of however long we're going to live. When we ordain, our preceptor gives us the first five of the 32 parts of the body. It's actually part of the ordination procedure. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. And interestingly enough, that's what we see when we look at another person and it's all dead. So, you know, in a very real way, we're confronting our own death. We're looking at it, although we may not see it as clearly as could be. Being in Thailand, you know, at Wat Phanantachart, our meditation monastery there, branch monastery for Westerners, it was originally a cremation ground, and the time that I was there, when Ajahn Pasano was the abbot, and the cremations were held right in the very center of the monastery, and regularly villagers would die and be cremated there. And for those of us who had grown up in Western societies where death is a bit more hidden away, then this was a real learning experience. Because in a Thai village life, they're a bit more down to earth, I think, have a bit more of a realistic relationship with death. You know, there's a different relationship with the grieving process, for example. You don't see such heavy grieving. There's a bit more of an attitude of, well, yeah, what do you expect? And the family would tend to keep the body in the house for 3, 4, 5 days or so. And in the tropical heat, you know, it starts to smell. By the time they bring it to the monastery, a bit of a parade from the village to the monastery, taking the coffin and put it up on the pyre after they've collected firewood in the forest. And then they take the top off and everyone can look. And the monks go first and then we go up there and, you know, often it's a villager that we knew, or at least recognized. But by this time, you know, they were significantly blue and starting to smell. So that's something that you rarely get a chance to see in the West. And there's just something so realistic about it. And it confronts our sense of self. You know, it can really confront our sense of self. But I certainly learned a lot from those experiences of a bit more of a lighthearted, open attitude towards death. Certainly around Wat Phanantachart, but generally in Thailand, I remember once, there was that one time, we mentioned it earlier, when Ajahn Kurunadamo was still a layman. We traveled down to Ajahn Jemnian's monastery, Wat Thamsir, and went with my mother and Sujato. And one day we were in the Kutian, a Thai man who had befriended us. He poked his head in. And he said, kind of excited, he said, "You want to see a dead burning nun?" And we're like, yeah, of course we do. So we all jumped up and said, yeah, dead burning nun, and it's happening in the parking lot. They just kind of set up some concrete blocks, not much firewood, and just had her there, I think, without a coffin, from what I remember, and we had just kind of burned her right there. Which is a pretty powerful thing to see. I've never seen it before. You know, see it close up. You know, what happens to a human body after it dies and in the process of burning up. And of course, when it gets really powerful is when we think, you know, someday it's going to happen to me, right? As long as death is interesting, but, you know, it's something that happens to other people. Old people, and it's never happened to me, not that I can remember. And that denial, you know, can just be so entrenched. It takes this kind of regularly reminding ourselves, you know, I am subject to old age, sickness, and death. And it's like this teaching that the Buddha gave to King Pasenadi, you know, when his queen died, when his wife died, who he loved, and he was grieving and he was upset. And Buddha said, well, look, you know, there's just some things which are unattainable, it's impossible. You know, that those things which are subject to aging don't age. Those things which are subject to illness or death, they don't get sick or die. Those things which are subject to ending or those things which are subject to destruction don't end or don't get destroyed. And so our level of peace, while we're still alive, is very much bound up with how much we accept that. Yeah, we come to terms with that. So, okay, well, this isn't the way it is. Whether we want it that way or not, it's not really the issue. How can we live with that kind of truth without creating suffering for ourselves? So here's a quote from Ajahn Chah. All of us have been born into this human realm. Whatever we gain by that, we're going to lose. We've seen people born and we've seen them die. And we just see this happening, but don't really see clearly. Where there's a birth, we rejoice over it. When people die, we cry for them. There's no end. It goes on in this way, and there's no end to our foolishness. Seeing birth, we're foolhardy, and seeing death, we're foolhardy. There's only this unending foolishness. Let's take a look at this. These things are natural occurrences. Contemplate the Dhamma here. So then, to take this practice inwardly, really to look. I remember the first time I had seen an autopsy in Bangkok. This question kept arising, well, what is actually the difference between this body, which is so-called still living, and a corpse? What's the actual difference? We saw a corpse. You saw a freshly dead corpse, but it didn't look like someone who was sleeping. There was something significantly different about it. But what was it? It was like something which was invisible. You know, when a person is sleeping, not moving, you can still tell they're alive. It's like something invisible, but something which you can still kind of detect consciousness in some form. But when someone dies, and they're lying, they're fresh, they haven't decomposed yet, they're not turning blue, they don't smell, not any more than they did when they were alive, then what is it? Often it's noticeable, you know, that the life force, whatever it is, has left the body. So what is it that carries around, you know? There's a Zen phrase for investigation, say, who is carrying this corpse around? Which is pretty much, you know, a real forest tradition style way of looking at the body. Who's carrying this corpse around? And what's the difference between this corpse now and when it dies? And that's a very fruitful kind of investigation. You know, what is the difference? Because it leads on to, you know, the really understanding the relationship between the mind and the body. So when you go throughout the day, I remember, you know, one monkey was saying, oh, well, you know, people talk about this as morbid. We'll see, of course it's morbid. Morbid, by definition, it means concerned with death. But that doesn't mean it has to be depressing or, basically, the idea is to let go, which actually brings a certain lightness and peace and happiness and joy. Those people who have gone through periods where they nearly lost their life often come through it with a great sense of ease and joy and gratitude. You know, they're just so grateful to be alive. You know, it's like they really were able to let go. And if we're able to do that, you know, while we're still alive, it brings a certain aliveness to what we're doing and a certain appreciation for how fragile our life is. And I think it just puts everything in priority in terms of, you know, what's really important in life, what's worth dedicating our life to. We don't know how long we're going to live. You know, food, for example, you know, we chant the meal chant before we food. We don't, you know, just eat for nutrition, you know, for the health of the body, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for intoxication, etc. So when we're taking our food, for example, you know, there's no need to be picky. We just need to just take, you know, something that's healthy and enough, and then that's good enough. It helps to put things in perspective, you know, changes our priorities and say, well, go to the table with all this food. Well, it's just a corpse. I'm just keeping the corpse going, right? No big deal. Take a bit of this, bit of that, bit of that. Okay, go. That's fine. And you don't need to spend much time over it. And, you know, just say, it doesn't really matter. You know, it doesn't really matter if we get everything just right, you know, of the foods that are there. Everything just what we want. In fact, it's sometimes even better, you know, to not get exactly what we want. Just take a bit of this, bit of that, bit of that. Go. Just keep the... keep the body going so that we can keep practicing the Dhamma. And that, I remember when people get into food issues, they can cause themselves a lot of suffering. There was one that came up recently. It was a monk in Thailand who had some real obstacles to his practice, and he had some food issues. And there was one time where he had a thing about peppers, hot peppers. He just loved hot peppers, and he just ate so many of these really hot chili peppers, you know, red hot chili peppers, and he just went way overboard on it, and he had to go to the hospital. Which, if he was wise, you know, that'd be a good reflection on death. Well, I could have died right there. You know, life is very uncertain. But the other aspect of death is peace. You know, resting in peace. And that's just so important for all of us, to have this opportunity to allow the mind to rest in peace. Our body gets rest when we sleep, but even when we sleep, it doesn't really mean our minds get a good rest. You know, still dreaming, thinking, worrying, happening, tensions carried in the body, but to really allow the mind to rest, you know, is just so necessary to be a balanced, happy human being. You know, allow yourself time to do that. Allow yourself opportunities to really rest. You know? Not physically, not just crashing out, but you know, rest in a Dhamma way, you know, just allowing your mind to settle down. And that can take time. It takes dedication. But that sense of developing peace is one of the greatest, most meaningful things we can do for ourselves, but it's also one of the greatest things we can do for society at large, that we can do for other people. Because really, no matter how much, you know, we'd like to make the world a more peaceful place, as long as our minds are agitated, as long as our minds are filled with the same things that are exaggerated in the world, then our ability to help is limited. But one of the greatest things we can do to actually affect peace in the world is to make our own heart peaceful. So developing the sense of peace then kind of leads on to this next thing I wanted to talk to. It's called simultaneous release. In Buddhist scriptures, you often get the when someone attains full enlightenment, arhatship, then part of the stock phrase is that the mind is liberated through liberated by mind and liberated by wisdom, kind of going together. And although there are different patterns to the way people get enlightened, the way people realize purity of consciousness, generally they fall within a certain spectrum. And this idea that liberation of mind is generally referring to developing peace, developing peace of heart, developing an inner quietude, developing samadhi, developing tranquility. Liberation by wisdom is more the a sense of investigation, understanding things as they really are, looking, dissecting. But these two aspects of meditation, of Buddhist meditation, then become very, very important in how we relate to them. The calming side, or samatha side, is more like unifying. And if we want to develop that, then it's important to just focus on the unifying aspect of things and not allowing the mind to go into investigation, breaking things down, analyzing things into bits. We're developing the investigative side of the practice, then it's very important not to allow the mind to slip into fudging over the differences between things. You really want to look very closely at how things exist and how they cease, taking them apart, analyzing them into causes and conditions and bits. And here, balance. I can't say enough about how important balance is in developing meditation in this way, because people can have so many opinions about meditation needs to be this way, needs to be that way, this technique is the only way, etc. But basically, when it comes down to just these qualities of mind, and the Buddha just encourages us to look and reflect in ourselves, are the qualities of calm and tranquility present? Are the qualities of insight, investigation present? And it's not like it's all set up. The Buddha says you need to do this first and then this, etc. All throughout the suttas, it's very much interwoven, these two qualities. One supports the other. They go together. You can't really have one without the other. When the Buddha encourages us to look at our own meditation and then reflect, is this a sense of peace, tranquility there, present in us? Is a sense of insight or investigation present in us? And if we see that a sense of tranquility is there, but not the investigative side, then we're supposed to make effort, put forth effort into strengthening that the quiet of the samadhi, samatha side, But then also giving rise to insight, investigation, analysis, not letting that slip, not just focusing too much on one. Or if we find that that quality of investigation is very strong, but we're lacking a certain tranquility or inner peace, then the Buddha says that's fine. Keep that investigation going, make that stronger, but give rise to the sense of tranquility. Don't abandon that. Don't neglect that. And if we find that both are missing, then he says, well, you know, you should really put forth a lot of effort to give rise to both of them. It's like a person whose clothes are on fire. Like a person whose clothes are on fire. What would their response be? Oh, yeah, I got enough time. Maybe next lifetime. Well, I'm busy. I've got emails. I'll put my clothes out later. I'm not worried. Oh, he said, look, clothes are on fire. We don't know how long we're going to live. We have this precious opportunity to practice the Dhamma. Develop enthusiasm, chanda. Develop energy, wirya. Develop effort, usaha. Develop exertion, usoli. Develop unremitting sati and sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension. I mean, really put some effort and dedication and enthusiasm into practice to give rise to these qualities. And if we look at our own heart and in our own meditation, those qualities are already there, as the Buddha says, you know, don't just get complacent. Put forth extra effort to eradicate the defilements. So these qualities always go together, and you can see how it works, you know. I mean, I did a lot of experimentation when I was a younger monk, and there were periods of time where I would just try to do samadhi. Just saying, all right, well, let's just, I'm not going to do any investigation, only samadhi for this period of time. But in doing that, when obstacles come up to a peace of mind, you have to use your wisdom, you have to use a certain amount of investigation. So really, there's no escaping it. You have to use, you can't just rely on willpower and repetition. And just trying to develop investigation, only vipassana side, you know, is that even possible? Because as soon as we start to let go of things, as soon as we do have any insight, then we're going to start to set things down. And that makes life more peaceful. That brings a certain peace into our heart. So really, they go together, because the more peace we have, the clearer we see, the easier it is to let go. The more we let go, the more we experience a cessation of suffering and stress and anxiety. The more peace of heart we get, the more peace of mind we get. And then they keep proceeding like feet walking up a mountain. So this simultaneous release is like release by both samatha and vipassana, or release both by samadhi and wisdom. The full quote, you know, one example of this quote is, if a bhikkhu aspires, or if a person aspires, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the liberation or release of mind, and liberation of and release through wisdom, that are free of defilements, with the destruction of the asavas, the defilements. Then let them fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not to neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, and dwell on empty huts. So the other aspect of this simultaneous release is that when something is released in our own minds and our own hearts, it has the effect of releasing the world in a very real way from a similar amount of stress or tension. Yeah. By the way, the sense of release, I mean, in Pali, release is, the Pali word for that is vimutti. Vimutti is like release or liberation, freedom, unless you're the abbot. So when a sense of release happens in our own, say, from our internal side, then there's also a sense of release in the world, because when you look at the Buddha's definition of the world, what was that? When one is released, the entire world is simultaneously released. There is no making an end of suffering without reaching the end of the world. This is a quote from the Buddha. Yes, yet it is just within this 5 or 6 foot long body, with its perception and intellect, that I declare that there is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path leading to the cessation of the world. So in a very real way, the world is what we see, what we hear, what we smell, taste, touch, and what we cognize, how we perceive things around us. And so whatever perceptual change, whatever wisdom arises in our heart, it's going to simultaneously change our world. So there have been some masters, when they attained final purification of mind, they said the entire world became enlightened at the same time from their perspective. Rajan Chah, when he would talk about the world, he said, you know, what's the world? The world the world's that mental state which is agitating you right now. That's the world. You know, let it go. Just drop it. Years ago, when I was still a layman, on a very rare occasion, I remember going to church. Kind of embarrassing to talk about now, but no. I went to church, and it was part of my investigation of spiritual communities. And they did one very nice thing, I remember. It was kind of a way of developing a friendly sense of connection with other people. And at one point, the leader of the congregation said, okay, please turn to your neighbor and introduce yourself. Smile, introduce yourself, say hello, etc. And it was a very nice way of creating a sense of warmth and community. So I like to say to people, you know, turn to your neighbor and smile. I just nice. And show some teeth when you smile. Teeth. See any teeth? That's right. That's what I want to see. Nice. If you look at someone's teeth, look at Ajahn Yetiko's teeth, right?
Yeah.
Now,
it's not possible now.
His teeth are the visible part of his skull. Can you visualize his skull? Or, you know, when you see someone smiling, can you visualize their skull? You say, oh, nice white teeth. Oh, yeah. I wonder what the rest of the skull looks like. Oh, yeah. Right, I can kind of imagine it there. Because this is very much part of the simultaneous release. You know, one side is developing peace of mind, trying to make it deeper, more refined. Right? And we really have to put our heart into it. And the other part is then investigating. You know, starting with the body, investigating what it means to be human, what it means to have a body. You know, both are very important. On the samatha side, you know, the Buddha said, well, look, if, as long as the monks and the nuns and the lay people are devoted and dedicated to practicing the jhanas, practicing samadhi, deep samadhi, then the Dhamma is going to last for a long time. It's very important. And on the investigative side, as long as we have make the effort and have the courage to really look at what it means to be a human being, then it's still possible, you know, for the Dhamma to continue. Now, in the forest tradition, the main avenue of investigation, the one that so much emphasis is placed on, especially in the beginning, is investigation of the body. Remember my first rains retreat I spent with Ajahn Piyak. And, you know, I had done little experiments with 32 parts and whatnot, but I went to him and asked for advice. So I've been doing this and meditation and this, and which way do you recommend that I go? And Lopa Piyak just said, you know, every meditation at the point where it's most peaceful, then visualize taking the body apart and putting it back together again. And do that 3 times, every meditation. So that is an excellent exercise because it takes a certain discipline of mind. You can't space out. You really have to concentrate. And at the same time, it's developing insight or changing our perception of how we view ourselves. Right? We start with the body and say, okay, if I'm a human being, let's start with the body. Well, what does it mean to have a body? What does it really mean? Often, you know, a good part of our practice as Buddhists, as monastics, as developing meditation is simply about informing our perceptions, you know, making our perceptions more and more in accordance with the way things are in reality. And interestingly enough, the mind, it's not, if it has the right information, it's happy to start acting wise. If our perceptions, I mean, our perceptions are radically skewed and diluted, you know, when it comes to our body, and it's good just to at least theoretically accept that. Because what allows information into the mind or the citta, you know, which then forms our perceptions and views, is what we pay attention to. So, for example, with the human body, if we're only paying attention to a very narrow sliver of the human body, then the information that goes in is going to be very limited, and then, you know, the mind says, okay, well, that's my information of reality, and then draws certain conclusions. You can't really blame the mind for being deluded. But mindfulness is like the eye of the citta. It's like if we direct mindfulness to look in places that we don't normally look, places that we normally overlook, or look at things in a way that we don't normally look at, then that can just allow new information to flow in. And then perceptions change automatically. You can't convince yourself to be wise. You can't convince yourself, oh, you know, I read here and the Buddha says that, you know, shouldn't be attached to this, should let go of that, should perceive things as impermanent. You can't force yourself to have perceptions. Dhamma works on a cause and effect principle, but what we can do is we can start looking with a sense of sincerity, honesty, usually a bit of courage, because when we start to look into areas that we're not used to looking, then often that entails a certain responsibility of change. We might have to change the way we see things, the way we understand things. We might have to make changes in our life. This is often why people don't want to look at new things, because of the responsibilities it might entail or the changes that might come from it. But specifically for us, if we're sincere about, for example, starting with understanding the body, we don't just look at it from one angle, don't just look at the surface of it. I remember when I first started doing this practice, it really turned my world upside down. It's like totally shocking. I mean, now in retrospect, I realize how sheltered or naive I was. But, you know, the first time I really started to systematically visualize my body while I was meditating, you know, there's a certain amount of calm. It wasn't totally calm, but whatever degree, the mind was calm. And then at that point, turn it to visualizing my body as I was sitting there, and then taking the hair off, visualizing my body without hair, and then visualizing the pile of hair in front of me. What does that look like? What does the body look like without hair? And then taking the skin off of the body and putting all the skin of the body in a little pile in front of me. What does all that skin look like once you take it off of the body? What does it look like? A little pile of skin. Mm-hmm. And then what does the body look like without skin? Well, now it's getting interesting. And then gradually go through the whole body like that. For example, you know, start to take some of the organs out. If you have a problem with thinking, visualize yourself without a brain. Take your brain out, set it down in front of you. Visualize your skull. It's a big empty space. Yep. Nothing much to think about. It's just the body. And then take your eyes out. Eyes looking back. Start taking internal organs out. Start placing them all in front of you. Start to get a pretty big slimy pile. Autopsies are very helpful. You know, if you go to see actual autopsies and see what organs look like, and then being able to visualize those in yourself, or visualize them kind of taking them out, and it can become more and more vivid, more and more real. And the more and more real it is, the more information goes into the citta, and the more our perceptions naturally change. Instead of just seeing a human body as, oh, well, it's got this shape, etc. But why does it have this shape? It's because the skin is being held up by muscles and bones and liver and intestines and, you know, everything that's inside. It's like, oh, right. And so you just start to see not just the surface, but you start to see everything that's, you know, it's like you don't see it with your eye, you see it with your mind's eye, what's inside. You understand what's inside and why the body looks like it does. And as you take apart the body, and the piles of different things are kind of growing bigger and bigger, and then you get the intestines, and they're like huge and slimy. And you get down to just meat and bones. And you take the meat and bones out, and all the meat goes, and then there's just the skeleton. You're just sitting there with the skeleton, and then the skeleton breaks down into a pile of bones, and then the pile of bones eventually turns to dust, and it's blown away by the wind or washes away with the rain until there's nothing left. And then you start building it back up again. in proper order, putting things back in the proper place. And then through that process, you come back to eventually sitting here, meditation, as we look like on the surface. And then a second time, you go through it again. And, you know, you can be creative. You don't have to do it just in terms of the traditional 32 parts. I have always found it more powerful or meaningful just to see what has the greatest effect on myself. So I kind of make up my own visualizations and see where, you know, where my sense of self lies. At some point, when taking apart the body, we stop identifying with it. And so, well, at what point do we stop identifying with our body? You know, if we cut off a certain amount of our body, we still identify with our body. We're just missing part of it. But if we take enough of the body away, then at some point we say, "Well, it's not me anymore." And so then we're really getting down to the crux of why body contemplation is so important, because it starts to fundamentally challenge a sense of me and mine, me being the body. I am the body is mine. So of course, it's like, how else could it be? But then you start to do this practice, and you know, you don't try to convince yourself the body's any particular way, but you know, you give the citta more information. You start directing mindfulness to places that we normally overlook. And you say, well, we're not making it up. You know, that's the way it is. We're not making it up. You know, it's like, well, you know, do you have lungs? Yeah, they're there. That's what they look like. Yeah, all right. And that extra information then goes into the citta, and automatically perceptions start to shift and change and become more aligned with nature, with the way things are. This is how wisdom can gradually grow. And when doing that, then, you know, at some point the sense of self can kind of jump out, you know, at least temporarily. You know, it's like you're looking back at the body. You know, it's more of a, in a more objective way. But our habits are so deeply ingrained, you know, as soon as we stop, or very soon after, that sense of self can come back in and, you know, go carrying on with this assumption that, you know, this body is me, that this body is mine. So a relationship to one's body is like so fundamental to practice. I mean, when I would go see other teachers, they would just, you know, over and over again, when I was a young monk, go to see different teachers and say, how do you recommend to practice? And they just come down, back down to body investigation over and over again. How do we relate to our body? You know, we might relate to it with a sense of thinking it's wonderful, thinking it's great. Right? There's a lot of sense of self in there. Or the opposite extreme is, you know, we may have aversion towards our body. You know, that's very much just bound up with attachment as well. Aversion to my body. Oh, it's too fat. My body's too skinny. My body is it's too tall, it's too short. It's too old. It's too young. Or it's too hairy. Or it's not hairy enough. Or whatever, you know. Then that type of relationship to the body can just, you know, lead to lack of self-esteem, self-judgment, self-hate. And again, the key thing is self, self, self. So when our teachers, our forest masters, Guru Bhajans, keep coming back to contemplating the body, they're not coming at it from a place of, you know, see your body as something horrible and disgusting, and develop aversion towards it. It's just take a good, honest look. Okay, well, what is the human body? I'm here practicing the Dhamma. I want to understand what it means to be a human being and develop happiness as a human being, reduce suffering as a human being. This is what the Buddha recommends. This is what teachers recommend. Okay, well, let's give it a shot. Let's look to see what is a human body really, and what is my relationship to the human body. When I would go to see Numpo Panyawado, who was a disciple of Ajahn Mah Bua, he would very calmly explain, you know, why it's so important to look at the body and our relationship with it, and how fundamental that is to developing meditation. And then there was another senior monk there, Ajahn Cherry, and he was also a lot more enthusiastic, very graphic. But again, always kind of hitting there, body, body, body. And pretty much every teacher I went to, starting with Ajahn Biek and Ajahn Anand, Ajahn Dan, definitely Ajahn Dan is like body, body, body. Until you're anagami, just keep investigating the body. And Ajahn Mah Bua talked a lot about it, Ajahn Mah Bua's disciples. And so why is it? I mean, aren't there supposedly like many ways to realize the Dhamma, realize enlightenment, 84,000 Dhamma doors? That's whatever. I don't know where that teaching came from, but many, many avenues. Why so much emphasis on the forest tradition? Do the forest ajahns lack creativity? And that's why they just keep coming back to the body. When I was looking into this, they said, a lot of the forest ajahns, they really did do a lot of experimentation in their practice. They really did look at different ways of practicing. But then when it came right down to it, what worked to really liberate the heart was this very down-to-earth, grounded investigation of the body. And not just the postures of the body, not just, that's an assumed part of the practice already, that we are paying attention to when we're sitting, when we're moving, when we're standing, when we're working, right? Because you think, well, why so much emphasis on just the first of the four satipatthana, or foundations, focuses of mindfulness? Why is there so much emphasis just on the first one? Are we neglecting the other three? With many of these teachers, when they talk about mindfulness practice, mindfulness of the body, contemplation of the body, there's an assumption that in daily life practice, the monks and everyone already is doing kind of being mindfully aware of their mental states, their moods, their emotions, their thoughts arising and passing away. They are already being aware of the postures of the body. Mindfulness grounded in the body, in all activities. There's an assumption that that's already there as a foundation. So it's not neglecting that. But as a way of liberating the heart, that's not enough. Or at least that's what a lot of these teachers will say. It's just not enough. It's a bit like just trimming branches out of a tree where they keep growing back. Or it's just like trimming branches off a big Himalayan honeysuckle. The more you trim it, it's fine, but they keep growing back. It's just useful on the level of sense restraint. Keeping that continuity of mindfulness throughout every moment, You know, from time we wake up in the morning until the time we go to bed at night, the every activity throughout the day, being with the body, immersed in the body, aware of mental states, moods, thoughts, emotions arising, passing away, being right there, being centered. But they say, well, that's not enough, though, to really free the heart. That's enough to kind of keep our defilements in check. But to really get the roots out, it's like you have to do this more in-depth body practice. And the mind is very, very tricky. People like Lumpur Tate, especially Ajahn Mahabua, when they had reached places in their practice, very significantly advanced places in their practice, where they thought that they were enlightened. They didn't see any kilesa or defilements arising. But then their teacher, Ajahn Mun, had to nearly force them to investigate the body. Because the mind is so tricky. And it wasn't like they were just only practicing samadhi. You know, they were wise people. You know, it's like they could see things around, everything arising and passing away, no defilements visible. It really looked like, well, the citta was pure. But their teacher, Ajahn Mun, could see that, you know, this was a tricky, very tricky cul-de-sac. And then the way, you know, fortunately, if you have a teacher who you have enough faith in, who can kind of knock you on the head a bit, metaphorically, and kind of force you, no, you have to investigate the body. Ajahn Mahabua kind of, you know, tells these stories about how, you know, he had so much respect in Ajahn Mun, and yet he was nearly arguing with him, saying, well, you know, that way worked for you, but this way works for me. Ajahn Mun was like, look, you dummy, you're overestimating yourself. Go back to the body. It's very simple, it's very basic, but it's very, very powerful. And really one of the most effective things, you know, we can do for our practice. Sometimes there's also a sense of, okay, well, that's okay for Thailand, you know, this body investigation stuff, it's okay for Thailand, but here in the West, we're a bit more sophisticated than that, you know, or maybe these Thai monks, they really have a lot of lust, but, you know, we here in the West, we have maybe more anger, you know, and we need to focus on that more. We're more mentally oriented rather than body oriented, so maybe we need to focus more on the mind. Anyways, there can be so many kind of intelligent arguments for thinking, well, okay, well, that's kind of a cultural teaching or appropriate for a particular time and place, but maybe not for me. But as far as I can see, I mean, Westerners have just as much lust or attachment to the body as Thais do. And especially for those of us who are kind of very intellectual and in our heads, body investigation is excellent for bringing the mind into the body, you know, getting out of our heads. Just bringing the mind into the body helps to calm the thinking down, bring things into balance, feel grounded, feel elemental. And it's great for samadhi. One of the biggest obstacle for deep meditation is sensual desire, attachment to the body. Right? I mean, there's no way you can develop deep meditation as long as some of the five hindrances are functioning in the mind. And the king of the five hindrances is sensual desire, kamachanda. And it's all about the body, you know, desiring things to see that we want to see, desiring things to hear that we want to hear. You know, it's about seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. You know, the body, sensual desire with regard to all of that. And that's one thing which you do find in the suttas as well. It's very much backed up in the suttas that it's only when one has really let go of the body that one's able to enter deeper states of samadhi. And then once you enter deeper states of samadhi, of course, that's when you're going to be able to really have some deep wisdom. Because without developing that deeper sense of samadhi, it's impossible, really, to be honest. It's just really impossible to develop deep wisdom. So they go together. Both are absolutely crucial. It doesn't really matter where you pick it up. You know, if you start with developing sense of calm and peace, or if you start with analyzing the body, you know, just keep alternating the two. Keep at it. The main thing is just to keep at it. And with the forest teachings, they're not, you know, they're not super complicated, but they're very effective. And what makes them special, what makes the forest tradition special, is that they just take what was really necessary, but then they keep at it, and then they stick with it, and they don't give up, and they put a lot of effort into it, and there's a lot of, you know, faith and energy and devotion and dedication. And so if you take a simple teaching very, very deeply, then it becomes a powerful way to change our life. And so this is a way of looking at the body which, you know, is different. It's not like being fascinated with the body. I mean, even if we're looking deeply inside the body, we say, oh, wow, that's neat. Oh, look at that. Oh, wow. It's like fascinating systems. I mean, you look at the human body is incredibly complex. You know, how all these systems interact with each other. And it's like this fantastic thing that nature has created. Wow, it's amazing. Which is true. It's not denying that. But the point of body contemplation in Buddhism is all about letting go. It's all about letting go. So it's only useful in directing mindfulness to the place that creates a letting go. If we could become fascinated with the body, then it's not going to work. I mean, that's like pathologists. How many enlightened pathologists are there just through their training? I haven't heard of any. Right, so it's not just, you know, knowledge of the internal organs or systems of the body. It's approaching it, directing mindfulness in a particular way, which then is going to lead to letting go. And particularly, the most important is the sense of anatta. Letting go of sense of self. You know, identification with the body. This is really the crux, the most important part of body investigation. And if you just keep taking it apart and putting it back together again, I mean, we may have to do this thousands of times, you know, but each time that we do it, a bit more sinks in, a bit more of a perceptual change happens. And then gradually that begins to inform our life. But you have to keep doing it because, you know, as soon as we stop, it's like the weeds growing back again. The old perceptions are so deeply ingrained. You have to keep coming back, and just keep alternating, not giving up. And then finding a community which supports that, again, is very important. So, finding a monastic community or a community of meditators that are going to support each other in a practice like this, supporting each other in seeing things in different ways, and accepting that seeing things differently than the mainstream is not only okay, but it's actually a good thing. It's very helpful to have a community which encourages that and supports that and understands that. So for those of us who are monks, remember, where I am in New Zealand, there's a lot of Sri Lankans, and they often translate, their English translations are often sometimes a bit different, like they often refer to monks as priests. It's like community of priests. Which, I don't know, it's good for my any perceptual attachment. I'm not really a priest. I'm a monk. But so who cares, it's like priests. And then of course the nuns, there must be priestesses. So you've got the priests and the priestesses. But anyway, what's important is when you have a community that is well-trained, that is it's very important. That's a real blessing. I mean, for those of you who live in California, to have a place like Abayagiri is just such a blessing, for all of you. You may not realize how lucky you are, but, the training in this monastery is excellent. I can say that because I'm a visitor. The training in this monastery is excellent. The quality of people here, is excellent. You get people who are very dedicated, very sincere, intelligent, have nice teeth, competent. Anything else? Good builders. Everything you could want in a monastic, and so that's a very rare thing. And so to have a well-trained group of priests and priestesses, is a real blessing. So, California, rest in peace. I offer this for your reflection tonight. Sadhu.